From Nebraska to New Jersey, Illinois to Alaska, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the federal surging of law enforcement assets into Washington, D.C. has made the nation's capital safer. Zach Smith of the Heritage Foundation is here with details. Charlie Kirk, the face of conservatism to generations of young Americans, has been assassinated. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with a remembrance. The $37 trillion national debt continues to grow, and the actions of the Federal Reserve have a big impact on what it costs to finance it. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Romina Boccia from the Cato Institute. And the state of Kansas has passed a flat tax. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council discusses the impact on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Donald Trump has surged law enforcement assets into Washington, D.C. in an effort to ensure public safety. It has been controversial, but effective. Zach Smith is Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's here to discuss. Zach, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Zach, we are nearing the end of the 30-day period where President Trump and the federal government have been able to really take federal control over public safety in the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C. There was initially a lot of discussion over the basis for the Trump administration's actions, and you have written extensively about this. So we're going to talk about the crime rate and what has happened. But before we do, talk a little bit about what they did was valid.
Because Washington, D.C. is our nation's capital, the federal city that is the federal seat of our government, the president, Congress, they have very broad authority to take certain actions. Now, you mentioned that 30-day window. That only pertains to the president's ability to take direct control of the local Metropolitan Police Department, D.C.'s local police force. Now, Congress can extend that 30 days. The president may be able to declare another emergency, but other actions the president has taken can and probably will continue past that 30-day deadline. For instance, the president can continue to deploy the National Guard in Washington, D.C. The president can continue to surge federal law enforcement resources into D.C. Eight federal agents like FBI, DEA, ATF, ICE agents, all of that surge, that focus, all of that can continue past the 30 days because, again, Washington, D.C. is our nation's capital where Congress and the president have very broad authority to act.
And act they have done. Let's talk a bit here about the scope of the problem. Of course, there have been some very high-profile crimes committed in recent weeks, the tragic shooting of a Jewish couple. We saw an attempted hijacking turned into the beating of an administration official. A congressional aide was shot on the streets. Then there was those on the left here, Zach, who are saying, well, the crime rate's actually been coming down. Why are we doing this now? Is it being done for political reasons? Talk a little bit about your analysis of that crime rate.
Look, those claims are nonsense. I even heard one shocking and unbelievable statistic that crime was at a 30-year low in Washington, D.C. Now, I found that statistic unbelievable, so I researched it, tried to find where it came from, and it turns out this was a statistic put out by the Biden Justice Department only a few weeks before they left office. But that claim that violent crime is at a 30-year low is objectively untrue. And one of the statistics I often talk about to show that that claim is objectively untrue is look at carjackings. In 2018, there were 148, almost 150 carjackings in the District of Columbia. If we fast forward to 2023, that number skyrocketed all the way up to 957, almost 1,000 carjackings. Now, in 2024, district officials claim, and I think there's reason to be skeptical of this claim, but they claim that they cut that number almost in half, all the way down to 497, almost 500 carjackings. But even if we accept the district's crime numbers as true for 2024, except that they cut the carjackings in half, that is still almost triple the number of carjackings that occurred in 2018. So crime objectively, violent crime objectively, was not at a 30-year low, and I think district residents widely have welcomed President Trump's actions.
Of course, the most serious crime that can be committed is that of murder, and your research has shown that the murder rate in the District of Columbia, about five times the rate of the national average. Let's talk about that murder rate. Since the president's action to bring federal assets into the district to improve public safety, what has happened to that murder rate? Has it gone down?
Yeah, of course it has. And what really stood out to me in particular was that immediately after the president surged federal law enforcement resources into the district, there was an extended period of time where no murders were committed in Washington, D.C. It was one of the longest periods in recent memory where no murders were committed. Now, what's particularly impressive about that is anyone who studies murder rates, who studies criminal justice issues, knows that, unfortunately, murder rates typically spike during the hot summer months. And so to have that extended period of time where no murders occurred, and to have that happen particularly during a time when you would ordinarily see the murder rate spiking even higher, I think shows the effectiveness of the approach that Donald Trump and his team are taking.
So we have seen some major improvement in Washington, the District of Columbia. As you mentioned, a federal city where the federal government has a lot more say and a lot more control than in other cities around the country. President Trump is now looking at Chicago and other major cities with crime issues, pretty much as all of them, unfortunately. Does he have the same authority to go into some of these other cities to help ensure public safety?
No, the authority wouldn't be the same. And so the legal mechanisms available are going to look a little bit different. For instance, if he wanted to deploy National Guard troops over the objections of Illinois' Governor J.B. Pritzker or California's Governor Gavin Newsom, then those troops would need to be federalized. And the actions that the National Guard troops serving under federal authority can take are a little bit different, somewhat more limited than they can take in Washington, D.C., or when they're ordinarily serving under state authority. But we've seen the president successfully utilize National Guard troops, federal troops, to protect federal property and to protect federal agents while they themselves conduct law enforcement activities. The other action that the president has taken, and I suspect will continue to take, is to surge federal law enforcement resources into some of those hardest hit cities. Again, the president is well within his authority to order federal agents like FBI, DA, ATF, ICE agents to go into those cities and aggressively enforce federal laws. And I think that in and of itself would send a signal that crime and lawlessness are not going to be tolerated anymore.
Unlike what we're hearing from some on the left, Zach, this isn't the first time in American history a president has used his authority to bring about civil order, is it?
No, absolutely not. In fact, there's a long history of presidents federalizing National Guard troops, deploying the military in appropriate circumstances. Keep in mind, President Eisenhower deployed the 101st Airborne. He federalized certain National Guard troops in southern states when officials were trying to defy desegregation orders. President Kennedy, President Johnson took similar actions as well. And so it is within a president's legal authority to take these actions in appropriate circumstances. And look, I think many Americans recognize that what President Trump is saying about the lawlessness and disorder that's happening in so many cities, Americans recognize that he is correct, that this cannot be tolerated, and that unfortunately it is simply due to the policy choices that so many local officials have made.
We have been talking with Zach Smith. He is Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Zach, tell us a little bit about Heritage. Also, as I've referenced earlier, you've written on a number of aspects of all of this. Where can they find those writings?
Sure. You can find most of my writings on my X feed at TZ Smith. That's at TZ Smith. Or you can go to heritage.org and see everything I've written, as well as all of the great content my colleagues have published as well.
Zach Smith of the Heritage Foundation. Zach, thank you for being back with us. Appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, where, like a lot of us today, we are deeply shocked and saddened by the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk and what he meant to generations of young Americans, and really to all of us. So, Scott, we're going to talk a bit about Charlie Kirk today. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Loman.
Of course, the Club for Growth, Scott, you are a major player here in all of the U.S. Senate, major U.S. Senate races, congressional races, gubernatorial races around the country. So you're plugged in to the pulse of what Americans of all ages are thinking. On this day, your thoughts about Charlie Kirk and his impact on America.
I think kind of to start things out, I just want to offer the condolences of not just myself, but the entire Club for Growth and our 500,000 members to Charlie Kirk and his family, his wife, his children, and all of his friends and people that loved him and really followed him and his movement. You know, it's just such a deflating moment. And I think your listeners know that we usually record this a couple of days before broadcast. And, you know, at this time, they don't have the assassin in custody yet, and it's just, you know, really disheartening on what happened, and, you know, I just personally feel a lot of grief, even though I wasn't somebody that was close with Charlie Kirk. I met him one time, and very brief interaction through mutual friends, but I think that Rachel Bovard, who is another good friend of mine, she put it well yesterday on X, and she said, there are millions of people that feel like they were friends with Charlie Kirk. And, you know, here's a man that was just 31 years old and got his start sort of in that Tea Party movement. He was from Illinois and a volunteer on Mark Kirk's Senate campaign and was a smart, young, bright voice that was attracted to Trumpism and America First and MAGA and really exemplifies what that movement stands for. And he's somebody that had strong faith in Jesus and talked about that a lot too. You know, the movement that TPUSA grew and influenced young people. It's a pocket of voters that Donald Trump did incredibly well with. And, you know, this is a political assassination. It is an individual, a leader, somebody with a bright future ahead of him. And, you know, in many ways, he was one of Donald Trump's top advisors. You know, I'm sometimes at a loss for words on exactly what we should be doing or saying about the political violence that exists today. And it seems like it's becoming too commonplace. You know, it's just, what, about 15 months ago, two assassination attempts on Donald Trump.
This pattern of political violence that we seem to be in here, Scott, it just seems to continue to become worse and worse. You referenced the two assassination attempts on President Trump. During Supreme Court confirmation battles and major cases, we've seen threats on our Supreme Court justices here in Pennsylvania. There was an assassination attempt on our governor simply because he's Jewish. What is it about the culture these days that is allowing this to take place, especially to somebody like Charlie Kirk? One of the things that struck me of the many comments that have been made about him here, Scott, is that he never raised his voice. He was not somebody who yelled and screamed and pounded the podium. He engaged in civil discussion, but yet look what has happened.
He was absolutely a free speech champion, and to have civil discourse is what our political system is intended to hold. And, you know, I think that there's a culture that exists that is desensitized to horrific violence and, you know, just the rhetoric of the far left in pointing at their opposition and, you know, calling them fascists and Nazis and you know, trying to make it okay to do what they do. You've got terrible instances where school shootings are often politically motivated. We learn that through manifestos and information that comes out. But, you know, we are in a time for choosing. And my hope is that we can move forward and represent the best parts of Charlie Kirk and the TPUSA movement, and still win over young people by showing them that conservatism and individual liberty and freedom and the principles that we all hold with limited government, that those should win out.
Well, Scott, certainly, as you referenced at the beginning of our conversation, our thoughts and prayers go out to Charlie Kirk's wife, two young children who are now without a father. making this tragedy even worse. Our thoughts and prayers go out to them. And for all those young people listening who were motivated by Charlie Kirk, the best way to preserve his legacy is to continue the fight. As President Trump said, fight, fight, fight. Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, a few words about the club.
Club for Growth is one of those organizations that I think is pretty aligned with Turning Point USA and Charlie Kirk. We want to reach young voters. We want to reach people through free speech and expression. And if you want to learn more about us, the website's clubforgrowth.org. But instead, today I would actually encourage you to visit Charlie Kirk's website and his Wikipedia page and learn more about him and his legacy.
Scott, thank you again for being with us.
You're welcome.
Financing the nation's $37 trillion debt has a major impact on the federal budget, and the actions, or lack thereof, by the Federal Reserve are a major factor. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Romina Bocha from the Cato Institute.
The national debt hit a new milestone just last month, $37 trillion. That's now the amount of money that the federal government has borrowed in total. It's an incomprehensible figure. What matters maybe more than that overall number is how much we have to pay every year to service the debt. That's a figure that is unfortunately on the rise too, because not only is the debt growing, but interest rates have been higher of late, as you surely know. So on today's program, we're going to dive into what that means for the government, for the federal budget, and also what it means potentially for Americans who are ultimately on the hook for paying back that staggering amount of debt. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Romina Bocia. She is the Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute. You can also find her on Substack at The Debt Dispatch. It's a really terrific newsletter. If you care about any of these big picture fiscal and monetary policy issues, you should absolutely subscribe to that. Romina joins us here on the program to talk about this this new milestone, the $37 trillion in national debt. Romina, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Glad to have you here, of course, once again on the show. And, you know, okay, let's start with, you know, $37 trillion. It's like an incomprehensibly large number. Probably the more important figure is, you know, how much the federal government has to spend every year just to service the debt. And that is, of course, a function not just of the size of the debt, but also the interest rates that are paid. And that, I think, explains some of the fight that's been going on lately between the president and the head of the Federal Reserve.
So last year, the U.S. federal government spent $900 billion just on interest on the debt. That is more than the federal government spent on Medicare and more than the federal government spent on the entire defense budget. And interest rates have actually also been rising. Yield curves are steepening as investors are becoming increasingly worried about the United States government's ability or willingness to service its debt without inflating away the value of that debt by printing more U.S. dollars and causing massive inflation. And President Trump hasn't really been helping this sentiment among investors by calling for cutting interest rates and replacing the Fed chair and now replacing one of the members of the Fed board. Investors are seeing that the President of the United States is putting immense pressure on the Fed to cut rates that outside analysts, including myself, believe is primarily driven by the president's desire to lower the cost of interest on the debt that the U.S. federal government has to pay. But that comes at a cost as well. If the president succeeds at pressuring the Fed into cutting rates when doing so otherwise would not make sense, that is called fiscal dominance, where your central bank, instead of making decisions based on monetary stability, meaning keeping your currency stable, maintaining the value of the U.S. dollar over time, instead of that being their primary concern, they would become more concerned with financing deficits for the fiscal authority, in this case, the U.S. Treasury. And when you have that scenario where a central bank decides to support spending by a government that spends beyond its means, that's when you get inflation. That's what you saw in Venezuela. That's what you saw in Argentina. And it is a recipe for economic decline.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, we've also seen that here, right? In the 1950s, right after World War II, the Federal Reserve's mandate was geared more towards reducing the cost of the government paying back its debt. And the result of that, again, if I'm not mistaken, was pretty high inflation for a while.
Yes, you saw fiscal dominance episodes both following World War II, but also significantly in the 70s when you had stagnation. And I believe that is a more likely scenario for the United States today because we're not coming out of a major war. Yes, there was big spending during the pandemic, but there were other economic factors that contributed to that post-wartime boom as well. Whereas what we're coming out of now is, we're not coming out of anything. In fact, we are heading deeper and deeper into an entitlement-driven spending crisis.
We're talking with Romina Baccia. She's the Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute. Romina, I just want to finish up here on something you just mentioned there. Obviously, in the federal budget, right, if the cost of paying for the debt every year gets bigger, as it has been for the last several years, you know, that has an impact on other things in the budget. You know, you maybe can't spend as much money as you want on something else because you got to put those dollars towards paying for the debt. Anybody who manages a credit card or a mortgage understands that phenomenon. But then this also has consequences in the rest of the economy, too. As the debt gets bigger, that has a sort of crowding out effect on decisions that are made outside of the government.
Yes, the crowding out in the federal budget we primarily witnessed in the size of the so-called discretionary budget, the amount of spending that Congress votes on an annual basis happening as mandatory spending, the amount that Congress has put on autopilot, primarily entitlement and welfare spending, continues to grow. But in the economy, the effects are more hidden because it shows up in lower wages. It shows up in lost opportunities. It shows up in fewer new jobs, high-paying jobs being created. And it also shows up in fewer startups getting funded. That has long-term implications. If people are less able to take smart risks, those things not happening is that missed opportunity or opportunity cost, as economists like to call it, that often goes unseen, but is just as real as the significant interest costs that both the government and American consumers and households are now facing.
Yeah, so both the federal budget and everyday Americans going to be impacted by the size of the debt. That means less growth, higher interest rates, all of that good stuff to look forward to. Romina, we got to have you back on here to talk about some solutions to this. I hate to leave it off on such a kind of a negative note here. There are some things we can do, but we'll have to have you back on another time to talk about that because we are unfortunately out of time for today. And once again, that is Romina Baccia. She's the Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy for the Cato Institute. Check out her work for Cato at cato.org and also find her on Substack at The Debt Dispatch and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Taxpayers in Kansas now have a flat tax rate. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
For more than a decade, a convenient myth has circulated among pundits and policymakers across the nation, and that is that Kansas, under former Governor Sam Brownback, tried a bold tax-cutting experiment and somehow failed. The myth goes something like this: cut taxes and then a destruction of your state will surely follow. But this very tall tale, so often repeated by some in state capitals and editorial pages, falls apart under even the most modest of scrutiny. It's not a lesson in economics. It's a case study in how false narratives can outpace facts. The so-called Kansas experiment began more than a decade ago in 2012, when the state passed a series of income tax cuts, which were rightly aimed at spurring economic growth and eventually eliminating the personal income tax altogether. It started out as a move towards smaller government and increased economic freedom, goals that have underpinned massive growth and economic prosperity in states like Tennessee, Texas, and Florida, just to name a few. But there's one glaring problem with this Kansas tale. The tax cuts were only part of the story, and they were never fully implemented as intended. Unfortunately, the legislation Kansas enacted wasn't close to the original effort from Governor Brownback and conservative legislators. so it was not anywhere close to a true test of pro-growth tax reform. Due to liberal legislators leading the Kansas Senate at that time, many of the so-called pay-fors in the legislation were eliminated, and the session adjourned with large increases in government spending. That's, of course, an unbalanced approach that ignores the basic fiscal principle that both sides of the government ledger matter. No serious economist would argue that slashing revenue while simultaneously inflating spending is a sustainable fiscal model. And yet, that's exactly what happened in Kansas. But the critics of the plan never told those facts of the story. Had Kansas coupled its tax cuts with meaningful reductions in spending, or at least controlled the rate of growth, the story would have turned out much differently. But when deficits emerged, the political appetite for spending reform collapsed. By 2017, the state passed the largest tax hike in history just to fund the massive appetite for spending from the political class. And of course, that undid much of what had been attempted just a few years earlier. The usual suspects in the media and academia quickly seized on this, declaring the experiment a failure. Progressive economists like Paul Krugman pointed out Kansas is definitive proof that somehow tax cuts don't spur economic growth. But that's not economic analysis, that's ideological opportunism. In reality, the Kansas story teaches us something much more basic. You cannot cut taxes and ignore spending. Fiscal discipline is not optional. It's the other half of the equation. What's often left out of the Kansas narrative is what happened in other states that learned from these mistakes, not by avoiding tax reform, but by doing it right. Take North Carolina, for example. It enacted a series of tax cuts over the last decade, including the creation of a flat tax and a plan to phase out its business income tax altogether. Unlike Kansas, it also reined in spending and reformed its budget process. The result? Economic growth, job creation, massive in-migration of residents from other states, and a thriving state economy. Arkansas, too, has steadily lowered its top income tax rates every year since 2019. While maintaining fiscal responsibility. In 2025, Mississippi and Oklahoma passed plans to phase out their personal income taxes entirely. These are not theoretical debates. They are real-world counterexamples to the Kansas myth, ignored by those who find them politically inconvenient. The notion that Kansas invalidated the benefits of pro-growth tax reform is not only misleading, it is intellectually dishonest. The state never fully implemented the tax cut plan. It abandoned the reform midway through and returned to the old model of tax and spend politics. The so-called failure was a failure of execution and political will, not of good economic policy. The good news this year from Kansas is that pro-growth tax reform came full circle and was enacted over the objections of liberal Governor Laura Kelly. But under the leadership of Senate President Ty Masterson, Speaker Dan Hawkins, and Majority Leader Chris Croft, the state enacted legislation to provide real tax relief and move to a flat tax on personal income. In short, the Kansas experiment is no longer an experiment. It is a distorted story used to shut down debate, devoid of nuance or economic context. If there's a lesson to be learned, it's not that tax cuts are doomed to fail, but that politicians must have the courage to match tax policy with commonsensical spending restraint. As with all things in economics, there's no magic bullets, only trade-offs. Those who ignore that reality will keep recycling the same myths. Those who learn from it may finally write a different story. Thankfully, Kansas wrote a much more positive story for taxpayers this year. For more information, you can go to richstatespoorstates.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WMIR-FM and WJXY-AM in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, along with WOND-AM in Linwood, New Jersey. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program, please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.